Good evening, everyone. Nice to see you. Welcome back to Thursday evening. I have a bit of a cold, a head cold, so that's why my voice is kind of strange, and I'm blowing my nose. I recently came across something that Albert Einstein had said or wrote in one of his books, but also in a letter that he wrote to a rabbi whose daughter had died at the age of 16. And he wrote about what he called the human optical delusion. Not optical illusion. We usually think, oh, we see something, it's an optical illusion. It's not really what it seems to be. Then he talked about the optical delusion. And that delusion is, although a human is a part of a whole, part of what we call the universe. But it's a part that is limited in time and space, right? We have just a certain lifespan and we occupy this space in the relative world. But we are a part of the whole. And he said the optical delusion is that we think of ourselves as being separate from the rest of the universe, rest of beings, things. Nature, we're very familiar with this in our practice. We're always talking about separation and non-separation, oneness and diversity, non-duality, duality, right? So it's interesting that someone like Einstein should say this. And he even went so far to say that the main fundamental issue of all religions is to free ourselves from this optical delusion, which he called, I mean, he said it's a prison. This optical delusion is a prison. It closes us in, confines us to our ideas, our position, who we love, who we don't love, to this very limited space, this really tight confinement when we see ourselves as separate. And he went so far as to say that all religions, their main issue is to free ourselves from that. And we know in our practice that's what it's about. It's clearly stated, it's a path of liberation, to free ourselves from the, we would say, the deluded idea of a separate self, which is exactly what Einstein is saying. And Einstein came to this by, we probably can assume, through science because and mathematics, because that's what he did. I don't think he's really considered a serious religious practitioner. I mean, I have never heard of any, he was a Jew, but he was Jewish, but I don't know of him having practiced being a devout Jewish practitioner. But he saw what this was. And he said, so when he told the rabbi, I don't know why I didn't see the whole letter, but oh no, he first wrote it to, he wrote this letter twice. First to one rabbi whose young son, who was like 10 or 11 years old, had died. And then the second letter he wrote later to a rabbi whose daughter had died at the age of 16. And I guess what he was probably saying in these letters was that by talking about this, was a bit like the Buddha's story of the mother with the dead baby and the mustard seed, where you've heard that everyone's heard this story more or less in one way or another, but I can imagine that these rabbis were like that mother, just despondent about their child being dead. And if they're even reaching out to Albert Einstein, it's really, that's the equivalent of the woman knocking on the Buddha's door. Or he didn't have a door, but going to meet the Buddha in the grove or wherever he lived, was living at that moment. And so each of them, Einstein and the Buddha, give a similar response. The Buddha says, "I have some medicine." She's saying, "How can you please save me? My son has died. Do you have some medicine for this or something?" And he said, "Yes, I do, but you have to bring me back a mustard seed from a house that has never had any death, that has not experienced death and loss like you." So she goes and knocks on each door, and each house says, "Yes, well, we did have someone who died here." They all had a mustard seed, because mustard seeds are very common in Indian cooking. But nobody could give her the mustard seed because everybody had experienced death. So she eventually goes back to the Buddha, having had, a great realization of, this wholeness, this circle of love and compassion that we are a part of, and that it's our shared loss. If one person dies, we all share it. We've all experienced it. We know what that is. And she was therefore able to let go of her separate grieving and despair. It didn't mean she was no longer grieving and despairing, but she could let go of it. And she buried her baby son and she joined the Buddhist community. Now, I don't know what happened with the rabbis who the Buddha told this story to. I mean, who Einstein told this to. But it's pointing in the same direction. He said, Einstein, even in no uncertain terms, that if humanity was supposed would s survive, it would have to do this. It would have to free we would have to free ourselves from this prison of seeing ourselves as separate, expanding our compassion and our awareness beyond ourself and our community and our neighbors and our beliefs and who we think we are and who we think the others are, So, what does that mean? So as I was thinking about that to this today, I had a dental emergency. A filling came out of my tooth. How when you have something that is in your tooth to plug a hole, right? And it came out when I was eating breakfast. I don't know when it came out. I think when I woke up, I had it, but while I was eating breakfast, I didn't have it anymore. And it hurt. It was like exposed then. And it's a tooth that I've had ongoing problems with. So I called my dentist right away, and there was a answering machine that said the office is closed today, Thursday, October 2 or something, whatever it was. Please call back tomorrow morning. And I was really not happy. And I had a similar experience with this dentist in the beginning in July when I was having trouble with this tooth. And I called, and the answering machine said, Our office is closed until August 26th. If you have an emergency, call this dentist, whatever. So I ended up going to the other dentist, but so I thought, again, he's not there, this dentist. What's his problem? He's never there, you know? And Anna said, well, my husband said, well, you know, maybe there was supposed to be the strike today, you know, and so maybe he anticipated it, and because people wouldn't be able to get there on the trains and the RERs and things. And I didn't like that version, you know. I was like, well, still, you know. So I ended up having to go to a dentist. Just, you know, a center in my neighborhood that had a slot open, you know, for an afternoon appointment. I couldn't wait till tomorrow and hope that my dentist could take me tomorrow morning. And so then, as the day went on, while I was waiting for my appointment, I discovered that today was Yom Kippur, which is one of the high holy, the highest holy day in Jewish, in Judaism, I think. And suddenly I thought, I wonder if my dentist is Jewish. I wonder if he's, you know, celebrating this holiday. I have no idea if he is or not, but and for some reason that changed everything. I was no longer upset with him. Of course, I had an appointment. I knew I was going to have some fix to my tooth, although it's always kind of uneasy going to a dentist you don't know and one of these dental centers, which you don't know what kind of dentists there are and whatever. But as soon as I could, so I, at first, when I was angry with him, I was completely just focused on myself. And even if he couldn't get to his office because of the train strike, or he was thinking that other people wouldn't be able to get there, so he would close the office or something, that didn't do it. But as soon as I thought, oh, maybe he's celebrating this holy holiday, that shifted. But that again, it was like, because he's part of my club of spirituality, right? It was okay because he's honoring his spiritual life or something. And I have no idea if that is what it is or not. But this gave me another perspective then. And I remembered Einstein's thing and said, you know, why couldn't I have this compassion for him when he was not there because of the trains? Or all of this, of course, is fantasy because I have no idea why he wasn't there. But I could have it if I'm thinking he's celebrating a religious holiday. And whatever he was, why he wasn't there, this was a really interesting practice for me then to open up and look at it like, so Einstein's position of the optical delusion and seeing ourselves as separate, and what we need to do to remedy that is to widen our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and all of nature, right? The universe, we have to embrace it all because it is us. He doesn't say it's us, but we are a part of that whole, is, you know. And so I thought, you know, we have in Buddhist practice, there's loving kindness meditation, which I have practiced, but it's not one of my regular practices, which that aims to do that. It aims to widen our circles. We start with people who are very close, and then we expand and expand and expand and expand. Or we do it the other way. We start with people who are really far away, and we come back closer and closer. In any case, it's about widening our circles and including and embracing. We in our practice, we have koan practice. We have this very deep intention of not knowing, of attention, of being attentive. So in our rituals or yogi or other practices where it's really being attentive to just what is. And through that, possibly then seeing things not as separate or seeing them like we like them or we don't like them, however you want to frame that, but as just another part of the whole, as me as well. This is our path to freeing ourselves from this optical delusion. We say, ask yourself the koan, who am I? You introduce that koan. You introduce that, who am I? And you have to let go of who you think, of your ideas about it. Just like Einstein is saying, we have to drop our ideas about what is. How far we can extend our circle of compassion. There's a poet, an American, she was the poet laureate of the US. I don't know if she still is, but Ada Limon, who is also a Buddhist practitioner, but she does practice loving kindness. And she practices with Susan Sharon Salzberg, who is the great priestess of loving practice meditation. And she talks about deep attention, she calls it. And this is also her poetry practice of being deeply attentive to what is here and now. And she said, through that practice emerges what she calls startlement, which is not actually a word. It's an invented word. To be startled is to be surprised. To be awed, it can be awe. And she said that this deep attention practice, she even has a poem called Startlement, and I think even a book, but this deep attention then brings us to a deep awareness, a deeper awareness of our connection and of our not being separate. It helps us to widen our circle to embrace it all. We're lucky that we have this amazing koan practice because that also does that for us. Every time we work on a koan, we are asked to be something else. Be someone else, be somewhere else, which is right here. It's always right here when you pass that koan. You're not somewhere else, but you're asked to go beyond what you think, your discursive thoughts and your beliefs and your projections and all of that, and just experience this right here now. Of course, it's through the filter of a story from someone else or a situation from someone else. But it always comes down to right here and now. What is it? And what that practice does is it, if we really do it and persist with it, it is a path to freeing ourselves from that prison of that optical delusion of separation and enables us then to live fully, rich, deep, a life that's rich and deep and full of love. Just from taking a question, just from opening to this, I don't know what the answer is to this question. What is this? Or there was that, there was a time when I used to talk about that, this technique, meditation technique I had, which I called yes meditation, where you just sit and whatever arises, you just say yes to it. It can be pain in your knees, it can be a thought, it can be an emotion, it can be a sound. Whatever it is, you just say yes. Yes. And this is a way of not rejecting. So allowing whatever it is to be there. It's there anyway. It's not just because you don't want to look at it doesn't mean it's not there. And we see how we do this all the time when we don't want to see something or we don't want to do something. It's just not there. We have an ongoing issue with a neighbor on the back of our house. The wall is falling down, the wall on their house of their building. And even that notion of their building, right? Their wall. Well, according to the legal documents, the city hall and the property papers and everything, it's their wall, it's their building. However, if it falls, it's going to fall in part on our side of the wall and could cause a lot of damage. So we're involved in this whole story with this, but the thing is, the people, it's désaffecté, as we say in French. It's there's nobody living there. It's prime Montreuil real estate. I mean, like one of the entrepreneurs who came to look at it was like, well, do you have money? We could just buy that and have, a huge garden and another house on the street behind us, if we had the money for it, but we don't. But the people who owned it, the guy who owned it died, and his successors are don't agree on what to do with it. And they're all just not doing anything. So one of them lives in Denmark. We've managed to get that far. And one of them has, there were three sisters. One is in Denmark, one died, and the other one lives in the Touquet, which is on the Normandy coast. So nobody lives there. It's clear that nobody lives there because it's really abandoned. And she, the one in the Touquet, is the one that we've managed to have some contact with, doesn't get it, right? So she sends people to us to give estimates for the work. And we keep telling her, it's not us. You have to give them access to your property. They can look over the wall from us, but they can't, they have to go in your property. The neighbor, fortunately, also on her the other street, has let sometimes the entrepreneur, the guys who are going to give her estimates of work, go there and can see over the wall of his side. But basically, I'm telling this whole story because she's basically just looking away, doesn't want to look at it, doesn't want to deal with it, and keeps pushing it off. Well, she's going to be faced with a huge legal suit and bills if that, it's going to cost a lot if that building collapses. She's also involved in a suit with the other side, which is this restaurant and music place, the Marbrerie, who they have leakage to their roof from her roof, and everybody's involved in this. So, this is just a story of we can all kind of identify with that lady of not wanting to look at it, not wanting to deal with it, and finding every excuse possible to not deal with it. But it's there anyway. So I say, we can limit our attention to just certain things, but it's there anyway, whatever it is. The universe is all here and now. All right here now. With that yes meditation, it's a way of saying yes to whatever it is. Yes. 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 Tooth. Yes. Water. Yes. Head cold. Yes. People on the screen. Yes. Dharma talk. Yes. Cat. Whatever. Whatever it is. Yes. That's like acknowledging it and bringing your attention to it, but without getting caught, because then there's something else that comes up and you have to say yes to that as well. If you have to keep saying yes, you can't be stuck on anything. It's when you say yes to this and no to that that we get stuck. But if it's yes to everything, then it's just okay. just this and this and this. Or the other meditation that I used to give was what I called the translation meditation, which was you'd pick a language that you don't speak, Russian, Chinese, I don't know, some language that you don't speak. And you say, okay, during my meditation, whatever arises, I'm going to translate that into that other language. So whatever comes up in my sphere of attention, I'm going to stop and translate that into Russian. In order to do that, I have to, when we translate, as we know, we have to take away what we know, the word that we usually would identify with that, whatever it is. We have to let go of that. Open the space, because if we, you know, if I'm trying to translate this into Russian and I'm stuck on glass or verre, I'm never going to be able to put another word on that. So I have to let go of glass, I have to let go of verre, and then open to whatever the Russian word is. Well, I don't speak Russian, so I don't know what that word is. So what this practice does is, it's a, you know, it's just a trick, like all meditation techniques are just a trick, to help you let go of your identification of this, whatever it is, especially this, you know. Because when you drop whatever languages you speak and you seek to identify things with, when you drop those away, you're just left with this open space. Because you don't know the other word for it. This is where, this is really beautiful practice as well, because what happened, this is what koan practice is too. When you let go of what you think about that koan, all the answers you've tried to give for it, you drop that all and you just hear with whatever is, that's when you know, that's when something arises. And it's like, ah, that's it. And you learn to identify that moment. You learn to recognize that moment when it's, ah, that's it. It's usually so subtle and so fast, though, that it's just gone. And we don't, we thought, oh, that's not it. Or we didn't even notice it, maybe, you know? These are all ways of helping us to expand and widen and not be caught by this delusion, this optical delusion. It's interesting, though, that that Einstein would use that word optical delusion, because it is too, it is in seeing. Because we see ourselves as separate. We see things as different, right? And of course, we have to recognize the differences. But seeing them different doesn't mean that we have to see them separate. Which we all know. I mean, this is like we've heard, this is the standard Zen conversation, right? But to hear Einstein say this to people who are grieving the loss of their children is quite amazing. It does remind me of the Buddha and the mustard seed. I would be curious, I don't know if it's even possible to know, if those rabbis responded to Einstein, and if they, you know, what their testimony was. Did that change something for them? Did they experience, like, the woman with her young baby? I don't know. So you see, so in my example with the dentist, it's really all the time that we can practice this. We see it arise. We receive, you know, receive this closing around oneself, and then we can see opening if we pay attention. You know, then we can see how it evolves. Hopefully, it evolves. Right? That's what our path is: that we evolve, and then we become free from that prison of self involvement and self-separation. And when we look around at the world, we see that's what the problem is. With all these different problems, and we can see that they're linked to this very basic, like Einstein said, this very basic issue. And the way that religions are used on the world stage today is so far removed from that, whether it's Christian fundamentalists or Jewish fundamentalists or Muslim fundamentalists or Hindu fundamentalists, whatever it is, they're moving so far away from that. They're really indulging in that optical delusion in the name of a path of awakening, But there's hope, right? As the poet who I mentioned, she said something like, whatever we are becoming together. She was saying that in context of the environment. Whatever it is that we are becoming it together. If we can see that, then that will change how we then engage with others and with nature and with the universe. Whatever we are becoming together. So maybe I will stop there, and hear if you have anything to share or questions, comments, whatever. I have to blow my nose, so.
Yeah, maybe. Thank you, Roshi, and hi, everyone. Just two things that came up as you were talking. I suddenly realized that the hearing about the mustard seed story, it's very touching how he actually gives a practice. I mean, part of my mind was thinking, well, he's so that the person is going to make is going to understand that the nature of dukkha and all that. But it's not that. He's actually very skillful at giving her something to do, and that also puts her in the service of others also. And I don't think I had thought about that story that way. Yeah, and the second thing is, as you were mentioning, the problem with the this owner of this house, and she's not taking care of it, and she's kind of looking the other way. How, when we do that, when we think this is not our problem, it actually becomes someone else's problems also. And so by not looking, by not paying attention, it has actually ripple effects, even if we think that it's so it's a very concrete example of that, of the rippling effects, and just not paying attention that it has rippling effects, and not taking the responsibility of the of these effects for others, not just for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the Buddha was quite incredible too with this, giving a practice. Great pedagogue, he was really astute. Yeah.
And maybe the reason why it struck me is I'm reading right now the latest book from Stephen Batchelor, and as always, one of his point is really to show how the Buddha, the way he reads it, is was never interested in kind of the theory and what he calls ontology, what things are. So like, but much more kind of putting something into practice. Very, very, very practical. Yeah. And maybe probably moving away from what is how yeah how what's the formula how to serve others or how to not sure how to say that how to Not sure what to say. Yeah. How to serve others. Yeah. Yeah. How to, yeah, serve. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and as we've seen in, you know, the texts we've studied in the study group of what the Buddha said and sutras and things, like you say, Joy, he was not interested at all in is it finite or infinite or is it this or that or what? That wasn't the point. You know, it was this freeing ourselves from was a path to liberation. You know.
Nice to see you all. This is just anecdotal, but I was very interesting that at the moment, Rishi, when you said optical delusion, we had two creatures on the screen, and they were two living creatures because they were blinking eyes and everything. It was really kind of freaky there for a minute. I don't know how that works, but it was fun.
That's true, there were two Krishas. But there was actually only one. And you see how then we could like make this whole story about but two Krisha is two.
It was only internet problems. Same Krisha. When you started your Dharma talk, Einstein, at the beginning of my Zen path, which was really far away when I was about 14 or 16, I think I'd already told you this, I had a stepfather that was a monk, a Benedictine monk for 20 years before he went to the lay life. And we were talking about sacred and profane. I don't know if, okay, so. And I was talking about how I firmly believe, and I could not speak about it, and something that kind of hold us all together. And I thought a lot like an ecosystem because I was in school and it was what we heard. And then also Einstein had, I don't know what, but he tried, I think, all his life, but maybe this is romanticized view of me because I'm not scientific or whatever. This idea of the you know, that he could never prove. I think he was able to prove relativity theory, but he tried, maybe in terms of physics, but he had the intuition, as I understand it, that there was something that was all us, or some kind of energetic or whatever. And I do believe now, it's not a thing that it's quite important for me, that somehow it feels like the quantic evolved a lot, and it feels like it's kind of trying to prove in a scientific way what Buddha was talking about. And returning to my stepfather, he was the guy, he was a religious guy, and you know, the sacred and the profane, it would be something like the sacred in our day to in the day in the daily life of a religious guy, more like this, something like this. And for me, in Zen, it's more about the sacred, like universal stuff, like the story of the mustard seed. When you open a lot to hurt, to love, to generosity, and that kind of big mystery that we all embrace, and sometimes, if we are open, it comes. There are great examples. I think like Mandela being in prison, and when he went away, he wasn't talking about being vindictive about the guys of apartheid or whatever. And well, I don't know. This was my call for Zen. And then, finishing the story, my stepfather told me, if he is a religious, I'm not, and he knew. He gave me the big book of Zen, and I started this path. Einstein was there also. Funny.
Great story though, huh? Yeah, wonderful. How fortunate, you know, that, yeah. That you should come to the Zen path from a Benedictine monk who was married to your mother. That's pretty weird, huh? If you think about it.
How open he was, because he was really religious. He was a Christian. He stopped believing in some kind of church stuff, but he was a profoundly Christian guy, and he was able to see for me what made sense was then. He was really cult, but he understand. He listened, understand, and offered me that book for my own questions of life. It was something I cherish. Nice to share with you also.
Thank you.
Also, Amy, you were saying that you didn't know if Einstein had a, we've never heard of him having a spiritual practice, but I can't, and I don't remember, I didn't see this myself. I heard somebody tell it. Someone said to Einstein, "Do you believe in God?" And he said, "I don't believe I know it. Do you believe God exists?" And he said, "I don't believe it. I know it exists." So he had some sort of dealing with his own mystical
Right.
perceptions.
Yeah. Well, and the notion of the profane and the sacred too. As we know that Bodhidharma went the radical path of nothing sacred, but that just meant that everything was sacred. That there's because as soon as you say something is sacred, well, then something else is profane. And a way of saying that everything is sacred, of seeing it all one, of seeing, including it all, of loving it all, is that it's nothing sacred or everything sacred. Claudia.
Hello, everybody. Amy, I'm very happy that at the beginning of your talk, I had a like a, it took me a while to understand that the feeling of a tooth was not a feeling. Like I was really wondering which feeling was coming out of your tooth, like the feeling to feel something. So I didn't, So I was like, wow.
Filling, yeah, different than feeling, yeah. Sorry, yeah.
How do you pronounce that?
Filling, like a f to fill something, you fill the hole in your truth with a filling. It's different than feeling.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
So I was very impressed that you had a feeling from your tooth. So it took me a while to understand. And after I just it just I thought it was interesting when you said about the meditation of the yes, you talk about that. And this is very funny because I experienced something yesterday night that I think I never experienced in my life. It was the meditation of the no. Because it was, and it's very funny because I think that tomorrow I will try the meditation of the yes for myself. But yesterday night I was like, I was going to, okay, I was going to my new guitar class and I didn't choose my teacher this year because for money reason, I have to go back to a place where I don't choose my teacher, and after I have a chanting class, and so I didn't choose my teacher either. But it was great because I was arriving there, and I really didn't like anything. I didn't like the when I arrived in the class, I didn't like the room, I didn't like new teacher, I didn't like what he was proposing me. And after chanting class, it was the same. I didn't like the students. It was very funny. I don't know, I never experienced that so strongly. It was for like 3 hours, I was like rejecting everything. And it was so funny that I could feel myself re rejecting things, but I was watching the people, and they didn't sing very well at all. They were really ugly, and I really didn't want to be with them. And I didn't like these new people, and that was the people I'm going to spend the year with. And it was great, but I couldn't see myself shrinking. I think I was shrinking, and at the end, I was very, and I could watch myself, and I was like, wow, so you are Zen student, and you just it was very amazing that to go through something like this and watching myself acting like this. And so tomorrow I will wake up and I will do the yes meditation and I will go to my or maybe I maybe next what Wednesday I will do the yes meditation during the class.
Yeah. And so it must have been a long 3 hours, huh? If it was just no. Yeah. Yeah. If with the yes meditation, it doesn't mean you have to like the room. It doesn't mean you have to like the teacher. It doesn't mean, however, but it does change the way that we experience it if we're not rejecting it. Yeah. Okay, well, if no one has anything to add, maybe we can stop there. And I just note that, well, I'll say that after the recording is finished. So thank you.